everybody, and welcome to the November 21st, 2019 public meeting of the California. In our proceedings, we will start with the
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. If you will, please rise.
Mr. De La Torre?
Here.
Mr. Eisenhut? Supervisor Fletcher? Senator Flores?
Here.
Senator Garcia? Supervisor Joya?
Here.
Ms. Mitchell?
Here.
Senator Monty? Mrs. Reardon?
Here.
Supervisor Serna? Dr. Sheriffs?
Here.
Precious Hurley?
Here.
Ms. Dagborian? Vice Chair Berg?
Here.
Chair Nichols?
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Great. A couple of announcements before we begin the regular agenda.
For safety reasons, please note the emergency exits to the rear of the room. In the event of a fire alarm, we're required to evacuate this room immediately and go downstairs by the stairs and assemble outside the building in the park across the street until we hear the all clear signal. Anyone who wishes to testify should fill out a request to speak card. They're available out in the lobby or from the clerk, and we appreciate it if you would turn it in prior to the commencement of that the item that you want to speak about so that we can organize the time and the lists. Also, we will be imposing our usual 3-minute time limit this morning. I don't think there's going to be a reason to shorten it, but if we see that we've got too many speakers and there's a good deal of repetition, we might shorten it, but we're not planning to do that today. We do appreciate it if you summarize your testimony in your own words rather than just reading it, especially if you submitted something in writing already. Now, before we begin again with the noticed agenda, we have a representative of one of our local air districts here who wants to make a presentation about CARB's incident air monitoring section in the Monitoring and Laboratory Division. This section's primary mission is to provide air monitoring support to help protect the public from acute exposure hazards of major unplanned air contaminant releases. A majority of their efforts go towards helping communities understand the impacts of wildland fire. And of course, we've had a lot of requests for their services in the last couple of years. Responding to these large and oftentimes very quickly evolving emergencies requires a coordinated effort between the local air districts and the response partners to provide air quality data to the affected communities so that they can take protective measures to reduce the health risks associated with exposure to smoke. Each year, the incident air monitoring team deploys portable air monitors to more than 50 impacted communities and collects an average of 38,000 hourly data measurements annually. And for those of you who missed it, the New York Times published an account of an article that was published in The Lancet talking about the impacts of fire not only on the health of children but also on the mental health of children who are evacuated and otherwise have to cope with these emergency situations. It's really sobering.
So fire behavior has become more volatile, and the severity of the fires has increased in recent years. As many of you are aware, the 2018 wildfire season accounted for the deadliest and most destructive wildfire season in California history, with 8,500 fires burning an area of 1.9 million acres. Butte County was severely impacted with the tragic campfire that destroyed the town of Paradise and surrounding communities and resulted in 85 deaths and the loss of over 18,000 structures. This month marks 1 year since the campfire, and while Paradise is rebuilding and rebounding, its devastation will continue to impact lives for years to come. The city is rebuilding. Crews have already removed more than 3 million tons of debris, rebuilt 9 homes, and they're on track to issue 500 building permits by the end of the year. Today, Jim Wagoner, who is the local air pollution control officer for Butte County Air Quality Management District, is here because he wants to recognize CARB staff for their work in the incident air monitoring. So, where are you? There you are. Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Chair Nichols and board members. I really want to thank you for having us here today to do this recognition. I want to introduce one of my staff, Jason Manley. And he's like my main contact for monitoring and has coordinated a lot with your section over the years. So Jason's here with me today.
Thank you.
While CARB really provides a lot of services and assistance to local air districts in a lot of different areas, and we certainly appreciate that, the services of this particular group, the incident air monitoring section, are really appreciated because they happen during times of emergencies. And while the support they provide are primarily due during wildfire smoke episodes, as you will see as I read the resolution, they also help in other areas as well. So with that, I'm going to take the resolution from Jason, and I will read it to the board and then present it to the section. So this is a resolution. This is from my board of directors. So this is before the board of directors of the Butte County Air Quality Management District, expressing appreciation for support from CARB's Incident Air Monitoring Section. Whereas the California Air Resources Board's Office of Emergency Response was created in 2009 and was reorganized as an Incident Air Monitoring Section, IAMS, in 2017, and whereas IAMS provides emergency air monitoring support to help protect the public from acute exposures of major unplanned air contaminant releases and other emergencies with air quality impacts, and whereas in response to the 2017 Oroville Dam spillway incident, IAMS assisted the district by deploying samplers to monitor for naturally occurring asbestos, as well as siting a weather station. And whereas in 2018, IAMS provided the district with experimental purple air particulate sensors for deployment and evaluation. These purple air sensors are currently providing valuable air quality information in communities throughout Butte County, including Chico, Oroville, Paradise, Magalia, Durham, Nord, Thermalito, and Biggs. And whereas in response to the 2018 campfire, IAMS assisted the forecasting capability of the district and the incident's air resources advisor by deploying portable particulate monitors in Butte County at the Tuscan Ridge and Palermo locations. And whereas in response to the campfire debris cleanup operation in 2019, IAMS assisted the district by deploying portable particulate monitors in Butte County at the Neal Road Landfill and Highway 70 Industrial Park locations, allowing the district to track and, if needed, manage dust impacts due to the debris removal effort. Therefore, be it resolved that the Butte County Air Quality Management District Board, on its own behalf and on behalf of the residents of Butte County, wish to express to the California Air Resources Board and the Incident Air Monitoring Section its sincere appreciation for past assistance and current readiness benefiting the residents of Butte County and the district. And so this was adopted by my board on the 26th day of September of this year. So with that, Charles Pearson, the will be accepting this on behalf of the section.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to have my team stand up and recognize my great team as well.
Thank you so much on behalf of the board. I think I can say that, you know, we don't hear often from Butte or many of our other more rural counties, even though we all know that these are some of the most beautiful parts of California, just simply because you don't have the large urban areas that tend to be the focus of our activities when we're dealing with non-attainment. So it's wonderful to see you here and to know that the work that we do is being appreciated and is also something that we're doing together. So thank you so much for coming. Thank your board, please, on behalf of all of us. Okay, our next item comes from San Joaquin Valley. It's the public meeting to consider a progress report on the ozone reduction activities. Mr. Corey?
Yes, thanks, Chair. In 2007, CARB adopted the San Joaquin Valley 2007 ozone plan for the 8-hour ozone national ambient air quality standard of 80 parts per billion. The 2007 ozone plan identified the emission reductions needed to meet the standard by 2023, along with the control strategies to achieve those reductions. Implementation of CARB's ongoing mobile source control programs provided the majority of the needed reductions. The 2007 ozone plan also relied on NOx emission reductions coming from future control technologies as permitted under the Clean Air Act. In 2011, CARB committed to update the air quality modeling in the 2007 ozone plan to reflect emission inventory improvements and other new information. This report includes the results of the updated air quality modeling. That shows that attainment of the standard by 2023 can be achieved through adopted CARB and district measures and therefore no longer relies on reductions from undefined advanced control measures. This is a good news item showing that we're on track to attain the 8-hour ozone standard in a timely way with emission reductions coming from adopted control measures. I'll now ask Laura Carr of the Air Quality Planning and Science Division to begin the staff presentation. Laura?
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Good morning, Chair Nichols, and good morning, board members. I'll be giving a brief update today on our progress in achieving emissions reductions to meet the 0.08 parts per million 8-hour ozone standard for the San Joaquin Valley. This update is related to the 2007 ozone plan for the Valley. The 2007 ozone plan identified the emissions reductions needed to meet the 0.08 parts per million 8-hour ozone standard by 2023. And laid out the state and Valley Air District control strategy necessary to achieve those reductions. The core portion of needed reductions came from ongoing implementation of CARB's mobile source control programs. The plan also relied on 82 tons per day of NOx emissions reductions coming from control measures that were undefined at the time. This approach is permitted by the Clean Air Act for extreme ozone non-attainment areas, allowing those areas to include emissions reductions in their attainment strategy from anticipated development of advanced technology measures. The state is required to define those measures 3 years before the attainment year. So since the Valley's attainment date for this ozone standard is 2023, measures must be defined by the start of 2020. The purpose of this report, then, is to update the attainment modeling from the 2007 ozone plan using an updated inventory, and to demonstrate that the state no longer needs to rely on undefined advanced technology measures, but instead can demonstrate attainment with reductions coming from defined, adopted measures already reflected in the emissions inventory. The board made a commitment in 2011 to update the 2007 ozone plan modeling to reflect implementation of control measures and emissions inventory improvements. For this progress report, CARB conducted modeling using an updated inventory that reflects emissions reductions achieved from CARB and district regulations and rules that were adopted after the 2007 ozone plan, including regulations achieving significant NOx reductions like the truck and bus regulation, the off-road regulation, and a suite of stationary source rules. The updated modeling aligns with the original modeling in the 2007 ozone plan, and it confirms the continued progress in improving ozone air quality. It shows that all Valley sites are predicted to attain the 0.08 parts per million standard by 2023, and furthermore, that over half the sites are predicted to also attain the more stringent 0.075 parts per million 8-hour standard by 2023. The updated modeling also confirms that the NOx and reactive organic gas, or ROG, attainment targets developed for the 2007 ozone plan are appropriate. Since all NOx emissions reductions are coming from CARB and district control measures that are defined and reflected in the updated emissions inventory, this eliminates the need to rely on the Clean Air Act provision for advanced technology measures to demonstrate attainment. This also eliminates the need to provide contingency for the advanced technology measures, although separate contingency for attainment is still required. The positive impact of emissions reductions on ozone air quality can be seen in the data. Between 2006 and 2018, the Valley 8-hour ozone design value for the 0.08 parts per million standard is decreased by 18%. And on average, there are 78% fewer days that recorded 8-hour ozone concentrations over the standard. These contour maps further illustrate the improvement in ozone air quality in the Valley between 2006 and 2018. Air quality data for 2018 show 13 sites already attaining the 0.08 parts per million standard, and no sites are more than about 7% above the standard. We've seen progress across all parts of the Valley, despite the particular challenges in the southern region due to geography and meteorology. In the northern region, all sites attain the standard. Also, as you may be aware, 2019 has been one of the Valley's cleanest ozone years. The preliminary design value for 2019 is 0.088 parts per million, and preliminary data for the year show no sites recording a fourth high value above the standard. We anticipate that these trends in ozone air quality improvement will continue with ongoing implementation of CARB and the district's NOx reduction control programs, and that the Valley will attain the standard by 2023. The Valley also needs to attain the more stringent 0.075 parts per million 8-hour ozone standard by 2031 and is on track to do so. As mentioned earlier, over half the sites in the Valley are predicted to attain this standard early by 2023. In March of this year, US EPA approved the Valley's 2016 ozone SIP for the 0.075 parts per million 8-hour ozone standard, another important milestone. Ongoing NOx reductions needed to reach attainment will come from continuing implementation of CARB's statewide mobile source control program, as well as from new measures in the Valley State SIP strategy, which the board adopted in 2018. The strategy includes commitments to pursue NOx reductions from a California low NOx engine standard and an inspection and maintenance program for heavy-duty vehicles, which, along with many other measures in the strategy, will be coming to the board soon for consideration. Staff recommends the board adopt the report and direct the executive officer to submit it to US EPA as a revision to the California SIP. That concludes the presentation, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
So first off, I want to congratulate the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District and our agency for this really very encouraging progress report. I have no objection to staff recommendation, but I wanted to make two comments. One is that the previous executive officer of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District blamed the ozone problem in the district to emissions coming from Asia. I and colleagues from UC Berkeley wrote a letter to Science objecting to the news report about that. And this nice progress, based on what the district and our agency have put in place, you know, puts the lie to that statement. It was obviously made a difference with our emission control strategies in terms of NOx in particular. So just to be clear about that. And number two is the Trump EPA has been bashing us for not meeting our required air quality goals, and this puts the lie to that as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Wellens. Other board members, before we hear from
those who signed up to speak. Okay. Well, that's, excuse me?
I do.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And I know the staff in their modest ways were tempted to put this on the consent calendar and pass over it, but, you know, I wore this tie. I don't know if you can see. There's a rooster on it, so, you know, get the good news out. Come on. You know, there's so many great stories to tell within this in terms of the cooperation between ARB and the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District in meeting this. You know, this not a black box, that in fact policies were put in place that have gotten us here and will continue paying dividends into the future. Policies have been put in place that will be paying off for years and decades to come, and as you've shown in one of your slides, in terms of health of State and Valley residents. So it's a great story. And yes, you know, when I first came on the board, ozone, everybody was worried about ozone. Oh, we'll never ozone. Good work all involved in that, because we're getting more than. So it's a sign of, yeah, we should be setting the bar high. We can do it. If we're clear about where the bar is, we can get there. We can get there. We work together and get there. We need high bars. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, it's, I don't think we're in any danger of running out of work to do, including in the San Joaquin Valley. So it is a good idea to stop every once in a while and see where progress has been made. And one of the things that I think is good about the way we measure and report these things is that we don't just take 1 year of good data, one good weather year, and say, oh, great, all is well. Our staff and EPA both really look very carefully over a long period of time to see what's happening. And I think we don't want to put out good news until there really is some good news. But when there is, it's the right thing to do. And I think it's particularly valuable, as both you and Dr. Bonds have indicated, to say if there's no other explanation other than the fact that the pollution control measures actually help bring down the pollution, let's just say that. You know, these are the things that we've been doing, which may have been somewhat difficult at the time, worked, and people should feel proud of what they accomplished. We do have three witnesses who signed up to speak on this item, so why don't we go ahead and hear from them, starting with Shiraz Rennie.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. My name is Shiraz Gill. I'm a Deputy Air Pollution Control Officer with the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. So yes, this is the first thing I want to point out. This is a huge success story, right? I mean, 2007 was really not too long ago, where we're grappling with how are we going to get these significant emission reductions. 82 tons is a big number, right? Fast forward just a few years, I mean, it's relatively a short time period, and we meet these commitments. That's a huge success. I truly want to recognize the collaborative effort between the district, who has implemented a very robust strategy to reduce emissions from our local sources, and the leadership of this board, CARB board, that has implemented a great set of measures to reduce emissions from the mobile sector. So it really should be applauded. I also want to recognize the staff of CARB. You know, we've been working very closely with them. We have a great relationship, and they've been really, really, really charming to work with. I'll use that word today. And so we really appreciate all the work. And of course, there's a lot more work to do, and we look forward to working with them. I also want to take this opportunity to thank and recognize all the businesses, industry, residents, and all the stakeholders that actually made the reductions happen, that invested in the technology in the San Joaquin Valley to improve and reduce the emissions. And, of course, so we should celebrate these victories, right, because we are always talking about a lot of the challenges, and we do have a lot more. And we look forward to working closely with your board, your staff, and all of the stakeholders to continue to reduce emissions in the San Joaquin Valley and to further improve the health of Valley residents. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning. John Loria with the California League of Food Producers. You know, when the updates first came about, I thought, you know, this is not going to be a very good thing. But actually, since this time, I think this is going to be an excellent example of how this district, and to show everybody how this district is going to accomplish exactly what we're trying to do. I've been with the league now for 10 years. God, I can't believe it's been that long. And, you know, having done that, I've worked with the air districts over those years. And I've always been very pleased with the fact that they do pay attention to what's happening for all the stakeholders, all the industrials, all of the residents and others that they need to address in order to be able to get there. So I'm looking forward to having this update process as it goes through to show the steps that a successful air district takes in order to be able to reach the goals when those goals are really, really tough. So I'm hoping that we can all learn from how the San Joaquin Valley has been successful in the past, and we can apply it going forward in the future. So thank you.
It's great. Thanks for being here.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Pinto Cabrera with Central Valley Air Quality Coalition. Good morning, Chair Nichols and members of the board. And thank you for providing this opportunity to provide comment, and thank you, staff, for your presentation. First off, I just wanted to, on behalf of CVAC, say that we appreciate all the hard work that has gone into the attainment of this standard. We know that CARB's aggressive mobile source strategies have paved the way for this process, and all breathers in the San Joaquin Valley really look forward to this attainment. Despite the progress, this attainment is just the beginning. We are very excited about this standard to be met. I would like to just encourage CARB staff as well as the Air District to just maintain this momentum. I myself am extremely excited at this progress that we have been making in the San Joaquin Valley. So as it stands, we have not met the ozone. We do not have an ozone plan to meet the U.S. EPA's 0.7 standard. The Valley Air District does not recognize the 0.7 standard in their RAN notifications and associated activity guidelines. So that's just something of concern for us moving forward. In fact, the number of days in the valley has spent above the 0.75 standard has not changed as much in the past decade. And with 2009, we spent 119 days over that standard, and in 2017, we spent 122 days over that standard. Progress has been coming slowly to the San Joaquin Valley, and we just want to focus on the protection of the health and well-being in the future for our residents. As we look forward to meeting this attainment, we just like to encourage CARB and the Air District and staff to keep the momentum up. We're extremely excited about this attainment, and we would just like to push for this momentum to maintain. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we do have a resolution on this item. Do I have a motion?
Second.
Yes. Oh, we officially have to close the record. Yes, thank you. I'm closing the record on this agenda item first, but we also have a motion and a second.
Second.
A motion and a second. Thank you very much. I think we can do this by a voice vote. All in favor of the resolution, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Any abstentions? No. Great. Terrific. Well, that's a good start. Let's now move on to the 2019 legislative summary. While they're getting themselves in place, I can say that the legislature has not forgotten about us. We've had a good year, all in all, and particularly with regard to heavy-duty vehicles. And we also had a very good year when it came to investments in a number of our funding programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve air quality, particularly in disadvantaged communities. The support of the legislature has been critically important in light of what's been happening in Washington and the fact that California has been under threat in almost every aspect of our environmental program, but particularly in measures that have to do with air quality and climate change. And so having the administration and the legislature in sync is even more important than it would be normally. And with that, I will turn this over to Mr. Corey.
Thank you, Chair. This year, as you noted, the legislature showed that despite efforts from the federal government to hamper California's ability to protect public health, California will continue to lead in protecting air quality and fighting climate change, particularly through our clean vehicle policies. And as noted, legislature showed particular interest in emissions from the heavy-duty sector, both in terms of greenhouse gases and criteria pollutants. Legislation, as an example, by Senator Leyva, SB 210, seeks to address harmful emissions of NOx and diesel PM from heavy-duty vehicles. The bill established a smog check-type program for heavy-duty vehicles, something that has been in place for passenger vehicles for nearly three decades. Complementary to this focus on criteria pollutants, Senator Skinner's SB 44 looks to address climate impacts and directs CARB to update the mobile source strategy with a focus on greenhouse gas emissions from medium and heavy-duty vehicles. This bill supports California's transformation to a low-carbon future. Legislature also expanded its efforts to encourage zero-emission vehicle adoption, complementing Governor Newsom's executive order that directs CARB to evaluate its incentives and policies in order to place 5 million ZEVs on the road by 2030. And this summer, CARB brought on a new legislative director, David Garcia. Prior to joining CARB's team, David spent 6 years at the Capitol as a committee consultant in the Senate Committee on Environmental Quality, and previously as staff for Senator Jackson and Senator Skinner. We're fortunate to have him on board. And with that, I'll ask Dr. Garcia of the Legislative Affairs Office to make some remarks. David.
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the board. As you just heard, my name is David Garcia, and I am your new legislative director. My office, the Office of Legislative Affairs, primarily tracks and analyzes legislation that affects CARB. However, we also provide support to the legislature on informational and oversight hearings that they may hold. We provide technical assistance to the legislature on bills that are before them for consideration, and we respond to a variety of other requests from the legislature, including requests for information on matters within our expertise, and we provide assistance on constituent affairs issues. Today, Nicole Hutchinson from my staff will be giving the presentation, and she will do a review of the first year of the 2019-2020 legislative session. She'll be highlighting some of the major bills that affect air pollution and air quality and climate change. And with that, I will turn the presentation over to Nicole.
Good morning. I'll begin with a brief overview before turning to the more consequential bills of the year. This year, members introduced 2,625 pieces of legislation. 1,042 of them, or approximately 40% of the bills, made it to Governor Newsom's desk. Of those, he signed 870, or 83%, and vetoed 172 bills, or approximately 17%. The legislature has historically taken great interest in CARB's programs, and 2019 was no exception. CARB's Office of Legislative Affairs tracked 403 bills and resolutions related to air quality and climate and analyzed 101 bills. The 2019 Annual Summary of Air Quality and Climate Legislation, which is included in your packet, summarizes bills that we tracked and also includes a section which summarizes CARB's new responsibilities. Of the 101 bills which CARB analyzed, the subject areas which garnered the most legislative interest in 2019 include bills which touched on climate policy, bills modifying or establishing incentive programs funded by the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and bills which touched on energy, among other topics you see listed on the slide. Here we see bills introduced and analyzed in 2018 compared to those in 2019. 2018 bills are represented by the yellow bar, and 2019 bills are represented by the green. As you can see, climate and GGRF continue to be areas of high legislative interest. We also see that there was a significant increase in 2019 compared to 2018 in energy bills and transportation, housing, and land use planning bills that our office prioritized. The interest in transportation, housing, and land use planning bills reflects the growing movement in the legislature to address the longstanding disconnect between the factors that shape regional growth and development in California and the state's environmental, climate, health, and housing goals, as well as within CARB itself, as evidenced by the creation of the new Sustainable Transportation and Communities Division. It's worth noting that many of these bills could fall under multiple subject areas. However, we organized them to the best of our ability to align with the author's intent. Key legislation we saw this year includes bills addressing emissions from mobile sources with a particular focus on medium and heavy-duty vehicles. Additionally, the deployment of zero-emission vehicles via budget appropriations and other policy incentives continues to be a legislative priority. The legislature demonstrated continued interest in wildfires, including the public health impacts of wildfire smoke. Legislators have also signaled a desire to coordinate housing policies through the lens of air quality and transportation. In the next several slides, I'll discuss these bills in greater detail. After 3 years of staff work providing technical assistance to Senator Leyva's office, the passage of SB 210 is a major win for air quality and public health. SB 210 establishes a comprehensive heavy-duty inspection and maintenance program, the first of its kind in the nation. Even with today's strict standards, heavy-duty diesel vehicles over 14,000 pounds remain one of the largest sources of air pollution in California. In terms of on-road vehicles, they account for over 80% of diesel PM2.5 and over 50% of NOx, all while only representing about 2% of the on-road fleet. This program, to be developed by CARB, will ensure that heavy-duty vehicles and their emissions control systems are maintained throughout their entire operating lives, much in the same way you or I are responsible for getting our cars smogged. The bill also contains critical enforcement features which leverage the expertise and infrastructure of other state agencies. Specifically, the bill requires someone who owns a heavy-duty vehicle to be compliant with the program in order to register or renew their registration with DMV. The bill also gives the California Highway Patrol, or CHP, the authority to issue citations for vehicles which violate the program while conducting their regular inspections at weigh stations. These stations include heavy in- and out-of-state truck traffic and will help improve enforcement for out-of-state vehicles, creating a more level playing field for all trucks in the state. CARB staff estimate that the cumulative emissions benefits of the program proposed by the bill are approximately 93,000 tons of NOx and 1,600 tons of diesel PM2.5 between the years 2023 and 2031. This level of NOx reductions is equivalent to removing 145,000 trucks from California roads, and the diesel PM2.5 emissions benefits of the program are equal to removing almost 375,000 trucks. These reductions will help ensure that CARB achieve commitments made as part of the SIP and reduce community exposure to harmful and cancer-causing pollutants. In addition to addressing criteria pollutants from this sector, the legislature also took interest in addressing greenhouse gas emissions from medium and heavy-duty vehicles. In 2016, CARB developed a one-time mobile source strategy which described the actions necessary to achieve air quality and climate goals for mobile sources. The strategy also identified the investments needed to implement those actions and was later used to inform the 2017 scoping plan update. SB 44 by Senator Skinner requires CARB to update that mobile source strategy beginning in 2021 and every 5 years thereafter. The bill requires that the strategy address how the state will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and criteria pollutants from medium and heavy-duty vehicles specifically. SB 44 also requires CARB to recommend reasonable and achievable emissions reduction goals for medium and heavy-duty vehicles by 2030 and 2050 respectively. This legislation will help support the transition to a low-carbon transportation future and help meet state air quality and climate goals. The legislature continued to demonstrate interest in accelerating the zero-emission vehicle market. AB 784 by Assemblymember Mullen provides an exemption from the state's general fund portion of the sales and use tax for the purchase of zero-emission buses, which are eligible for CARB's hybrid and zero-emission truck and bus voucher incentive project, better known as HVIP, through 2023. The bill allows the exemption to be taken in addition to incentives provided by HVIP, but does not require participation in the program. This tax exemption provides a dependable means to help offset the higher upfront costs associated with zero-emission buses compared to their internal combustion counterparts and will help accelerate the deployment of this technology. Similar to what we've seen in the last few years, the legislature continues to introduce legislation aimed at understanding and mitigating the impacts from wildfires. The last few decades have been marked by increased frequency and severity of wildfires, with 19 of the 20 most destructive California wildfires occurring since 1990 and 10 of the 20 most destructive fires occurring since 2015. Health effects from wildfire smoke that occur within a 24-hour period are currently unknown. AB 661 by Assemblymember McCarty will help fill this data gap by ensuring that short-term air quality metrics associated with health effects of wildfire smoke over 24 hours are included as part of SAC Metro AQMD's Wildfire Smoke Emergency Plan. The legislation requires that these metrics be approved by CARB. Additionally, the bill requires CARB to report to the legislature on existing air pollution emergency response programs for wildfire smoke statewide. This report will include best practices and where implementation of best practices could assist local communities. CARB's report will also assist the legislature in identifying communities most in need of resources to best implement best practices to protect residents from smoke exposure. In 2017, the legislature passed AB 179, which requires the California Transportation Commission, or CTC, and CARB to hold at least two joint meetings per calendar year. The purpose of the joint meetings is to coordinate on CARB and CTC programs and policies that have a nexus to achieving California's transportation goals and allow for a better understanding of the connections between CARB and CTC transportation programs, policies, and goals. This year, the legislature added a representative from the Department of Housing and Community Development to the joint CTC-CARB meetings through the passage of AB 185 by Assemblymember Grayson. HCD will be participating at the April 29, 2020 joint meeting. The bill also clarified that the intent of these meetings is to coordinate policies that jointly affect housing, transportation, and air quality. Turning to funding, AB 74 was the budget bill in 2019. This slide covers the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, or GGRF, appropriations for CARB. As you can see, the legislature made significant appropriations to CARB to support its community-oriented air quality programs and low-carbon transportation projects. In total, the legislature appropriated $1.5 billion in discretionary funding, and of that, $828 million was appropriated to CARB. Of the $828 million, $275 million is dedicated to incentives for AB 617 community emissions reduction programs and technical assistance for community-based organizations. $550 million is dedicated to CARB's farmer program and low-carbon transportation program, which includes projects such as the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project, HVIP, equity projects such as Clean Cars for All, and freight pilots and demos. The legislature also appropriated $3 million to CalEPA for two studies to help inform efforts to reach California's 2045 carbon neutrality goal. The framework for the studies were developed in coordination with CARB and other state agencies with a focus on the transportation sector. As I talked about earlier, we tracked over 400 bills and resolutions this year. This slide shows the general upward trend of bills relevant to CARB. The up and down you see generally follows the first and second year of the two-year legislative cycle, the second year having more bills than the first. We expect this upward trend to continue next year, including new bills and bills from this session that didn't make it across the finish line. We look forward to updating you next year on what the legislature was interested in and how that will impact our work on air quality and climate change. The Office of Legislative Affairs relies on close coordination from a dedicated team, as well as assistance from staff in nearly every division and office at CARB, to whom our office is incredibly grateful. We would like to specifically acknowledge the work of legislative analyst Andrew Tsu and program staff for their work at the start of this year coordinating a response to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. The effort required coordination and input from all divisions at the agency. Our office also welcomed three new members of the team this year, Legislative Director David Garcia, Deputy Legislative Director Cheryl Laskowski, and Analyst Megan Cleveland. Also on our team, the Legislative Office includes Robin Neese, Dominic Ballone, Nicole Cunningham, and Steve Trumbly. Thank you. This concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Dr. Bombs.
Well, first of all, thank you for that excellent update. I had a specific question about AB 661, the McCarty bill about wildfire impacts, wildfire smoke impacts. First of all, I welcome the fact that our agency is now required to approve what the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District has to design for emergency response. I have to say, I've been very upset. Some members of the staff have already heard me talk about this. With the Bay Area Air Quality Management District's stance on wearing N95 respirators, echoed by all the Bay Area County public health officers, which is in direct opposition to the US EPA wildfire smoke, a guide for public health officials with CDPH has signed off on. Both the local district in the Bay Area and the health officers of the nine counties say that N95 shouldn't be worn by people with any type of pre-existing heart or lung disease, which is absolutely wrong. Those are the people that should be wearing it if they have to go outside. Staying inside in a clean space is better. There are individuals with severe heart and lung disease that shouldn't wear N95s, but I'll just mention my wife. She knows I do this publicly, so she gives approval. She has asthma that gets exacerbated by wildfire smoke. She's exactly the person that should wear an N95 if she has to go to work, which she does. She has normal lung function in between her asthma attacks. She's protected from an asthma attack during wildfire air quality poor episodes by wearing the N95. Somebody who's on oxygen with severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, probably shouldn't wear an N95 mask, shouldn't go outside when there's a wildfire air quality emergency. But I object strongly with the, you know, I can't even say how strongly to bad advice coming from an air district and from public health officers who should know better. Right in Sacramento, during the campfire, we had the city giving out free N95 masks, and then the county health officer saying that people shouldn't wear N95 masks because it gives a false sense of protection. That is an issue. The communities need to be, the public needs to be educated about who should or shouldn't wear an N95 mask, and it's not the best way to protect yourself. But if you have to go outside, an N95 is appropriate to wear. If you have pre-existing heart and lung disease. So I hope that in our efforts to implement AB 661 that we will use nationally approved guidelines as opposed to, I think, by the seat of one's pants, recommendations that occurred both in Sacramento in November of last year and in the Bay Area most recently. And I also would be happy to work with staff on whatever we're doing with regard to 661.
Well, I think you'd already have put in a lot of extra time and effort and made yourself available, publicly during these episodes, and it was very helpful. But I remember how scary it was during the campfire when we were here for a board meeting, and just walking from the hotel over to the building was treacherous.
And just to be fair, I did see an example of a false sense of protection. As I was walking back to the train station, a guy was jogging past me wearing a 95. That is the wrong thing to do.
That was definitely the wrong thing.
Madam Chair?
Well, nobody said that public health was easy.
On this issue, I just want to say, I am so, so glad that Dr. Baums mentioned this, because this has become a major issue we're dealing with in the Bay Area, and I'm sure other parts of the state, that we have, coming from county government, we have county health officers, even from different counties, saying different things. We have air districts saying different things. This is really bad, because the advice I've given is what John Baums just said. And I've talked to our own health officer. In fact, I mentioned this to CAPCOA, and Judy, you were there, when we spoke to CAPCOA, and they says, oh, we have a policy, we'll look at this. I think what we need is to get the State Health Officers Association, which are the health officers of all 58 counties, and CAPCOA on board with the same advice. It is confusing to the public and distressing to pick up a Chronicle article quoting someone that says, from a county health department, saying, don't wear these things. It is irresponsible, and someone needs to take some control here. Being in county government and on an air district, I think, so CAPCOA and county health officers need to meet, get on the same page. Maybe CARB can help facilitate this, because this happens every single time, and it's a disservice to the public, because I get literally dozens of calls on this every time there's an incident in our office, and it is really hard. And I give John's advice, which is, you know, very, how do I say this, conditioned on many factors. I get that some people won't listen to all of those things, but we owe it to the public to give them information instead of it just doesn't work. So is there somebody, I just want to see a commitment. I've talked to our health officer to bring this up at the County Health Officers Association for the state. And do we know, is CAPCOA following up on what they mentioned to Judy and I, and I think who else was there? Judy, you, me, and there was right, at the CAPCOA, to have a commitment that they sort of figure this out. It doesn't make sense to have one state association say one thing and another, because people listen to both. So air districts and county health officers need to be on the same page. And until they are, I'm going to keep raising this issue like John has, because it happens every single time. And it's, you know, and one last point of frustration, it's easy for folks at one level to say something. There's one media market, right? And so as soon as somebody over here says it in this media market, I'm just talking in the Bay Area, and it's reported, everybody else sees it, and then there's a different point of view in another paper, and it's reported. And then what's the public to believe? If we can't straighten this out, something's wrong.
Kurt, do you want to comment on this? Because I think this falls within your area of jurisdiction.
Yes, please.
There's lots of frustration here.
Absolutely understood, Supervisor Joya. And Dr. Baum, thank you for those comments. I am one of the staff people that Dr. Baum has been talking about in terms of needing to have a statewide consistent message on how to protect yourself in these unfortunately more frequently occurring events. We are reaching out to CAPCOA, but also because we believe it needs to be a statewide message, it needs to come from a consistent voice within state government. So we're also reaching out to the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. They have staff that are particularly looking at the impacts on children. So we're bringing that in and then working out and then reaching out to the Department of Public Health. We are going to list, as he just volunteered, Dr. Baum to help us with this effort. So we have something in place before the end of this current fire season, but certainly before the next. In the last spate of fires, we did have Jared Blumenfeld, the Secretary of Cal EPA, actually film a video that was on YouTube providing this type of health information. But that does fall into the trap of it was one more voice saying something that was conflicting with some of the other voices. So the consistency is absolutely necessary. We understand your point, and we'll carry that message forward with the other agencies and with CAPCOA and the county health departments.
Okay. Yes.
A lot of frustration, which also means a lot of opportunity. And I think this is clearly something we can all come together and win on in terms of getting CAPCOA together with us, with the Office of Emergency Health. And San Joaquin Air Pollution Control District is working on this because of its interest in controlled burns and the effect that may have on public health and exposure. So trying to get the message straight, and it's not simple figuring out how to coordinate with the county health officers, but yeah, very important to get a consistent message out to the public rather than a confusing message out. And I'm hopeful that, because it seems to me pretty obvious, we can come together and get a consistent message. We really, the public health officers can be key in terms of other important health messages that we have to get out and deliver. So I'm hoping it'll be something that we can build on in the future, and a great opportunity.
Yeah. I think that's right. It's a the more important the issue, the more entities and individuals who feel a need to weigh in and talk about what's going on. So I think we can expect there's going to be more confusion rather than less, actually. But I think we can play a useful role here, and we should. So I'm pleased to see that people are already on top of this. Do the best we can. Is there anything more that we need to say on this particular item? If not, perhaps we should just congratulate the staff on a busy and good year. I've had generally good feedback overall when I run into legislators, or more likely am called in to explain what we're doing to them on various issues. And it's been overall, I think, a productive year. So I'd like to think that the legislative members of our board have been making a difference quietly, that in ways that we don't know about, and I'm sure that's true. So in addition to the public activities, just the fact that you're here is, I think, is important to us. So thank you. And I think we don't have to do anything with this report other than receive it, and thanks very much. Okay. Our next item is agenda number 19-10-4, amendments to the low carbon fuel standard. The low carbon fuel standard, as this board is well aware, is a key part of our climate policy portfolio for achieving both the AB 32 and SB 32 greenhouse gas reduction targets. It's a critical policy. It's something that was invented in California and is now at least being considered in many other places, but we started it here, and it has proven to be extremely useful and I think in many ways better than we thought it was going to be when we first started. So we owe thanks to many people, but I want to particularly recognize the role that the transportation studies community played, and our own Dr. Sperling in helping bringing this one forward. So we have some amendments that are focused here on reinforcing the existing cost containment provisions, and also propose a framework for ensuring that a significant portion of the revenues that are coming to electric utilities from the sale of credits for residential electric vehicle charging are directed to benefiting disadvantaged and low-income communities. And additionally, we're also looking at the creation of a clean fuels rebate that provides critical rebates on the hood, as we say, for supporting further deployment of zero-emission vehicles. We have been greatly benefited in getting to today by our vice chair, Sandy Berg, who has been working consistently, persistently, and valiantly for many months now to help the utilities build up a framework that this program could be workable and implementable. And I want to thank everybody who participated in getting us to this point. So, Mr. Corey, would you please introduce the item?
Yes, thanks, Chair. The purpose of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard regulation is to reduce the carbon intensity of transportation fuels used in California, thereby reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and to diversify the fuel pool to enable long-term decarbonization of the transportation sector. And as you noted, these amendments are very targeted and are being proposed in response to Board Resolution 1834. The purpose of the proposed rulemaking is to reinforce the existing cost containment mechanism in the Low Carbon Fuel Standard by establishing a hard price cap on credit transactions and allowing a limited amount of credit borrowing in the unlikely situation it is needed to help entities comply with the program. The proposed rulemaking also directs a portion of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard revenue from residential electric vehicle charging to disadvantaged in low-income communities to ensure that these communities further benefit from the increasing adoption of zero-emission vehicles in California. And with that, I'll ask Firas Abu Sanai to begin the staff presentation. Firas.
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Good morning, Chair Nichols and members of the board. I'll walk you through the proposed amendments to the LCFS. The low carbon fuel standard is a key part of our climate strategy and is designed to reduce the carbon intensity of the transportation fuel in California by promoting the use of low carbon fuels. As a result of the LCFS, low carbon fuel consumption has grown significantly in California, which is helping to reduce our reliance on petroleum fuels, improve air quality, and advance technologies to achieve our climate change targets. Last year, the board directed staff to work with stakeholders to reinforce the cost containment mechanisms in the LCFS and establish an equity component funded by credits received by utilities for residential EV charging. Today, staff is proposing amendments to the LCFS in response to this board direction. In addition, staff is proposing minor clarifying changes related to the implementation of the Clean Fuel Reward Program, which is the statewide point of purchase EV reward program adopted last year. Prior to going through a detailed description of the proposed amendment, this slide provides an overview of the key features in the LCFS that provide compliance flexibility and minimize the overall costs for regulated entities. First, entities can generate credits by investing in the production of alternative fuels, and also in a variety of GHG emission reduction projects at refineries and oil fields. These projects could include carbon capture and sequestration, use of renewable hydrogen in refineries, and using solar steam or renewable electricity generation in oil fields. Second, entities can purchase credits from other credit generators who provide alternative low-carbon fuels or implement emission reduction projects in California. Third, although there are separate benchmark schedules for gasoline and diesel compliance, credits are fungible between diesel and gasoline sides, providing the opportunity to overcomply with either standard to meet overall compliance. Fourth, credit banking allows regulated entities to plan and prepare for future compliance needs by overcomplying in earlier years. Currently, there are about 8 million credits banked in the program, which can be used for future compliance. With these flexibility mechanisms, a regulated entity has several options to generate or procure credits throughout a year for demonstrating compliance. Regulated entities demonstrate compliance at the end of the year by retiring a credit for every deficit. However, if an entity is unable to procure sufficient credits, then the program provides additional mechanisms to support compliance and ensure the stability of the credit market. First, a credit clearance market, or CCM, will be held in which the entity must purchase its share of voluntarily pledged credits. The price of credits in the CCM is capped at $200, indexed annually for inflation. Second, any deficits remaining after the CCM can be accumulated for up to 5 years with an interest of 5% annually. This 5 years of deficit banking is designed to provide sufficient time for the entity to make investments necessary to achieve compliance. However, if accumulated deficits are not cleared within 5 years, the entity is out of compliance with the regulation and subject to financial penalties. In the next few slides, I will be describing proposed amendments designed to reinforce the cost-effective features of the program. First, staff is proposing to extend the $200 maximum price within the credit clearance market to all credit transactions occurring in the LCFS market. The maximum price protects the interests of consumers and stabilizes the market by eliminating the possibility of short-term price spikes resulting from market speculation or manipulation. Second, in the unlikely event that a credit clearance market is held and insufficient credits are pledged to cover all deficits, staff is proposing to allow for advancing a limited number of credits from future years to match the shortage in the clearance market. As indicated in the figure on the slide, staff is proposing these credits be advanced from the future issuance of residential EV charging credits allocated to large investor-owned and publicly owned utilities. The cumulative number of credits that can be advanced will be limited to 10 million. We are confident that any advanced credits would represent real reductions from the future because the deployment of EVs will continue to grow and we modeled a conservative scenario. This following illustration shows how the advanced credit mechanism will work. In the unlikely event that a CCM is held but insufficient credits are pledged, the exact number of credits will be advanced to large IOUs and POUs to meet that shortage. Utilities will sell these credits to deficit holders at the maximum credit price. As with all utility credits, the revenues must be invested in the Clean Fuel Reward Program and other projects promoting transportation electrification. The advancing of credits will provide additional stability to the market while at the same time accelerating the transition to electric vehicles in the state. Although the credit clearance market is intended to provide additional compliance flexibility, it is not intended to be the primary tool for regulated entities to rely on for long-term compliance in the LCFS. The program has always been designed under the principle that entities must make sufficient early and ongoing investments in low-carbon fuels to ensure long-term compliance. Therefore, staff is also proposing that entities who participate in the clearance market for 2 consecutive years will be required to submit a compliance plan detailing their compliance strategy for the next 5 years. The compliance plan must be approved by CARB, and the entity will be required to provide an annual update on the status of its implementation. The compliance plan, staff understands that these plans could contain market-sensitive and confidential business information and would like to reassure that all information of such nature will be protected. Before discussing the next set of proposed changes, we will provide a little background information on credits from residential EV charging and the status of the Clean Fuel Reward Program. Credits from residential EV charging, also known as base credits, are issued to utilities in proportion to the number of EVs in their service territory. Revenue generated from sale of these credits must be used by the utility to benefit EV drivers or promote transportation electrification in California. In 2018, the board adopted changes to the LCFS regulation requiring a minimum portion of base credits to be contributed to provide a statewide point-of-purchase EV incentive, also known as the Clean Fuel Reward Program, or CFR. The remaining base credits, which are not contributed to the CFR program, are called holdback credits and can be used by utilities for funding other programs that promote transportation electrification. Currently, electric utilities are working with automakers and dealerships to develop and implement the CFR program. The program will be funded exclusively by LCFS value and will be in addition to other existing state and federal incentives, including the Clean Vehicle Rebate Program, or CVRP. In August, the CPUC accepted Southern California Edison's proposal to be the administrator of the program for the initial 3 years. In addition, utility stakeholders have finalized a governance agreement and submitted it to the CPUC for approval. Once the governance agreement is approved, third-party implementers will be hired to design and run the program. We believe this additional incentive at the point of purchase will promote light-duty EV adoption. Staff will provide annual updates to the board on CFR implementation. To better facilitate CFR implementation, staff is proposing some clarifications in these amendments. To ensure that each EDU makes their CFR contribution consistent with the program framework developed cooperatively by all utilities, staff is proposing that each EDU must sign the governance agreement. For those EDUs that do not sign the agreement or choose not to participate in the LCFS, all credits for residential EV charging in their service territory will be directed to funding the CFR. This will provide greater cash flow certainty to the CFR funds. Also, to help develop a cost-effective program and to maximize the reward amount, staff is proposing to include requirements for capping and reporting of administrative costs. The last focus of the proposed amendments is to introduce an equity framework for the use of base credits to ensure that all California residents continue to benefit from transportation electrification projects funded by the LCFS. To that effect, staff is proposing that a minimum share of the proceeds from holdback credits must be used to support transportation electrification that primarily benefit disadvantaged and low-income communities and low-income individuals in California. As indicated by the table on the slide, the value available for equity programs could reach $180 million in 2024 and will continue to increase in future years in proportion to the number of EVs in the state. Staffed work with environmental justice groups and NGOs to identify several projects that would qualify under this provision, such as electrification of school and transit buses, additional rebates for new and used EVs, deploying EV charging infrastructure in multifamily residences, innovative electric mobility solution in disadvantaged communities, multilingual marketing, education, and outreach, and incentives in the forms of rebates or credits for low-income individuals for using public charging. This is a suggestive and not exhaustive list of projects. An EDU may also work with local environmental justice advocates and local municipalities to propose other equity projects that could better serve disadvantaged and low-income communities in their service areas. These proposed projects would be subject to executive officer approval. Utilities will provide CARB with an update of how proceeds from base credits have been spent, including the percentage that was dedicated to equity projects and administration in their annual reports to CARB. Staff intends to continue working with stakeholders in order to provide further clarifications in the regulation as part of targeted 15-day changes. These potential changes include ensuring sufficient funding for administration of the CFR and equity programs, allowing low-income rural areas in addition to the disadvantaged communities to qualify for equity spending by utilities, and clarifying responsibilities for sellers and buyers in the credit clearance market. Staff recommends that the board approve the proposed amendments and direct the executive officer to work with stakeholders to propose and finalize any appropriate additional conforming modifications to the amendment. Thank you for your attention. This concludes staff's presentation.
Okay, we have a list of 12 people. It's up on the board there who've signed up to testify on this item. So let's get started.
Thank you.
Beginning with WISPA. Oh, okay. There you
Good
are.
Morning, Chairwoman Nichols and members of the board. My name is Kathy Reyes-Boyd, president of the Western States Petroleum Association. And although John Larea has 10 years under his belt, this is going on my 30th year at WISPA. So I'm here to talk about the credit clearance market of the low carbon fuel standard. And I really want to appreciate and recognize the board and the staff for really putting some focus on this, because I think we all realize that it may not be enough to respond to credit shortages in the program as we go forward. And we believe, as I know you do as well, that this program has to provide certainty, and it has to provide that for the obligated parties that have to comply, especially one that governs an important part of the California economy, as this one does. So if it appears there's a lack of compliance options in the future, this can be viewed as a liability by shareholders, and it makes it tough to attract investment into the market, which is what you want. And in fact, some investors can stay on the sidelines if they feel there's too much uncertainty surrounding the program, especially on its long-term viability and sustainability. So the staff's borrowed credits proposal is certainly a step in the right direction. We still fear it falls short of ensuring market certainty and stability and a regulated entity's ability to comply to address this possible situation that Richard Corey referenced that could require more than the 10 million borrowed credits. So we appreciate the resolution language today that you put forth. It directs the executive officer to continue monitoring cost containment provisions. It continues to work with stakeholders to evaluate the proposals to further strengthen the program. It considers future program adjustments to ensure long-term effectiveness of what cost containment features we have and regulated entities' ability to comply. And lastly, it directs the executive officer to report to the board annually on the status of new credit generation, which is a really important piece of this, and then progress against the targets. So we believe these elements in the resolution will certainly help provide the regulatory certainty that all parties need and deserve. So we appreciate those actions, and we appreciate the staff's willingness to continue to ensure this is a viable program with these provisions going forward. And just in closing, I just wanted to congratulate this board for its continued efforts on a program I am very passionate about, which is AB 617. And we just had a wonderful three-day session in Yosemite. Dr. Sheriff, Dr. Balms participated in that, and I can tell you it was the best collaboration I have seen in 30 years in bringing a conversation with communities and business and agencies together to figure out how to deal with these community concerns, and having the communities lead that discussion is remarkable. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Perfect timing. Okay. Mr. Delahousse.
Good morning. First off, I submitted some written comments earlier this morning, so I would encourage you to read those. They're more in detail, but I'll just hit a couple of highlights from you today. First off, NESTE is committed to the success of the California LCFS, and more importantly, the broader goals of transforming the world's energy to reduce carbon impacts and increase sustainability. As you're aware, NESTE's been a key active participant in this market, providing large volumes of renewable diesel and then those corresponding carbon reductions, aiding compliance to date. Were it not for some of those early investments and early participations, the current success might well be in question. We've also, as a company and an industry, made significant investments in production technology, feedstock development, and logistics to ensure that markets like California can continue to reduce emissions from the heavy-duty transportation sector. We and others have interpreted those signals of this market of increasing that, and have made significant investments in new production capacity, new technology development, and new products like aviation fuel. However, significant changes in the program design could disrupt those plans and continue to put continued production product availability and new investment decisions in jeopardy. NESTE, again, supports this program and agrees with the staff that it's a well-designed market and that it's not going to have significant cost containment implications. And therefore, we would suggest that these are undue and unnecessary at this time in a well-functioning market, particularly with the caveat that the CCM, the credit clearance market, is existing, has a cost containment provision for those obligated parties that choose to participate in that, and has the option, as outlined by staff, to have that compliance in place. However, if for individual reasons people want to go and do individual transactions to have a different compliance plan, we don't think that it's appropriate to over-regulate that market and extend those to all credit prices rather than having that, rather leaving the market alone in the credit clearance market of it all. Most importantly, we think that that $200 price level was set several years ago before California has increased its targets and before other markets have come online and then further extended their targets. So putting a hard cap in place does not allow flexibility in the program to continue to send a positive market signal to make California the most attractive market that might attract fuels or other low-carbon solutions in from some of the competing ones as they continue to grow, as more continue to come online, and as more continue to extend and their greater carbon reductions. Also, we would look at the borrowing of the electricity credits. While it's important to have a process in place, and that's a good outline out there, we don't think the program fully encompasses the negative impacts from deferred carbon reductions. A carbon reduction is more valuable today than it will be 5 years from now. This program has no provision other than just the reinvestment of new future carbon reductions to take account for that. Obviously, it's a program like this is not static. As market prices go up and down in a free market, that'll be taken advantage of. And it's important to understand that short-term blips will be taken care of by a free market. And I would caution against over-regulation and creating uncertainty that can cause from keeping too heavy hand on that.
So just to be clear, your recommendation would be not to change the current status quo, to do nothing?
That's correct, because we think the credit clearance market is sufficient. Yes, ma'am.
Got it. Thank you.
And could I... Chair Nahan, so just to be clear on that, so you think that, ideally, I think you said you'd like to see the credit cap to be higher, right?
I think it should have more flexibility in it than having been set that long ago and not revisited. But potentially higher, I think, is an open question. But more specifically, having staff directed to look at that and determine if that's still an appropriate level.
And not some of these changes you think are over-regulation, as you say, unnecessary?
Yes, sir. I think if the credit clearance market price were revisited, addressed, and set at a real level to attain the true cost of carbon, I think that would be a sufficient fix with the existing regulations.
So that means a higher credit price?
Potentially, yes, sir.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nichols. Members of the board, I'm Chris Hessler with AJW. We represent organizations that contribute about 20% of the credits needed for compliance to this program. And I want to continue the theme of the last two speakers. This really is about certainty. It's about making sure that companies understand the rules of the road, even when the program's under stress. So I applaud the staff for having the foresight to set some additional rules out about how this program will operate in the event that it comes under stress, in the event that there's not enough credits. I think it's a really important signal so that investors understand where their risks are and how the program will work in the unlikely event that it does come under stress. It allows the major oil companies to make longer range plans. The further out they go, the less certainty they have about how the market's going to behave, and this gives them confidence so that those investments can be made. So I want to applaud the staff for doing this. I also want to point out that this program, as you said, Chair Nichols, is getting more attention from other jurisdictions, and it's because of this foresight. It's because of this commitment to making sure the program will work in the real world for real companies, both on the new fuel side and on the traditional fuel side. So we've got New York State and Minnesota looking at this. We've got Canada in the next few months is expected to bring out their clean fuel standard, largely modeled on what you've done. Unfortunately, not exactly copied on what you've done, but you know, this is the example that others are following, and now in Mexico they're talking about it. So it's essential that, you know, we talk about California trying to lead the world on these things. It's not just the ambition. It's not just setting an ambitious target. It's creating programs that do this hard work of looking at how things will work in the market and deal with all the complexities that come along with that. That's what attracts capital. That's what brings new technology solutions. So, again, well done on the staff for this really important, even if it seems like it's in the weeds, really important strengthening of the rules of the program.
Good morning, Chair Nichols. Hi. and esteemed board members, my name is Bedia Harrell. I represent City of Pasadena Water and Power. And I just wanted to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today on the changes. I'd like to thank the CARB staff for the hard work that they've done. And I wanted to show support for the LCFS program. We believe that is one of the major vehicles for deployment of EVs in the state of California. So thank you, everyone. We want to state that we do agree that a portion of the revenues from the holdback credit should be used in the disadvantaged and low-income communities. It does create access to cleaner air and cleaner vehicles for all residents within our service territory. Pasadena has implemented programs that specifically target DACs and low-income individuals with additional benefits to mitigate barriers to their participation. What we would like to urge the board and staff to consider is some more flexibility on the portion that is required to serve solely the DAC community. We believe that it should be proportionate to the percentage of DAC in our community, and we look forward to meeting and working with CARB staff for the implementation. Thank you.
And thank you for coming.
Good morning, Chair Nichols and members. Nina Kapoor, the Coalition for Renewable Natural Gas. We are a nonprofit trade association based in California that represents the RNG industry across North America, including the producers of over 95% of the RNG in the LCFS today. We strongly support staff's concept for additional credit price containment within the LCFS and believe that the proposed rule is a useful addition to an already successful LCFS program. Specifically, we believe that a hard price cap stabilizes the program and protects the interests of regulated parties and consumers by eliminating the possibility of short-term price spikes in the program. We believe that the cap is set at a level that can reasonably expect to draw new supply into the market, and that the price cap grounds expectations for developers of new projects and sets a ceiling price for all counterparties engaged in credit generation and sales. Given the cap is set at a level that is sufficient for many projects to work financially, having such a cap will actually help the financial products develop around the LCFS due to reduced uncertainty. We thank the staff for their hard work and due diligence in the development of this proposal and urge its adoption today. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is John Dinan. I represent, first of all, thank you, Chair Nichols and fellow board members up there. Thank you for having this forum. I represent a company called Generate Capital. We're a private company that is an owner-investor of renewable energy projects. That includes solar, energy efficiency, battery storage, sustainable transportation, and waste-to-value projects. I personally run the waste-to-value business at Generate Capital. We are engaged in the LCFS through providing biogas to RNG, solar to EV, and we own clean electric buses that operate in California. I am here to support the cost containment measures, really echoing what Nina just said, the same reasons. I'll maybe go into the second derivative of the reasons. Price stability, we do believe this will eliminate price spikes. Why is this really important? So, take a step back. I am an investor. I look at projects whose business models and financials and projections are based on the LCFS program every day. Price stability is key to bringing lenders, real project finance lenders, into the space, Wall Street. Okay? It's not generally playing in the space right now as a lender, as a bank. Most projects are alternate banking markets, which are not as efficient, or all equity. The projects we have invested in are mostly equity. We believe the price incentivizes new production of clean fuels, as Nina said, and we also believe it removes uncertainty and really clarifies market expectations. And this is less of a market thing. This is more about how does a renewables project become a project. It starts with developers, and they have expectations, and they need to know which project makes sense and which one should they go and develop, and then they have to find a finance company to go and pay for it. And having this cap really helps make that piece of the market more efficient in our view. So thank you for proposing this amendment. Generate Capital applauds the work of the Air Resources Board, continued efforts on this program. They are very, very valuable and appreciated. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nichols and board members. My name is Zach Franklin. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Grid Alternatives. We serve as the statewide administrator for CARB's one-stop shop pilot project, as well as other low-carbon transportation equity programs that the agency is running. We want to express our strong support for the environmental justice provisions of the new amendments, the commitment to environmental justice from the board, from the staff, not just with your words and your values, but with your financial resources is commendable. We also want, per our written comments, to recommend one minor but we think important change to the regulations to make sure that these amendments reflect CARB's SB 350 barriers report and guidance on how to decrease barriers to access to these programs in low-income and disadvantaged communities. As you know, that study includes extensive input from environmental justice stakeholders from throughout the state and identifies the need for a coordinated process for folks to apply for and access all of the different resources that are available to them. The good news is that there's a lot of funding available to support transportation electrification in low-income and disadvantaged communities. The bad news is there's a lot of funding available in these communities, and without coordination, it can be very difficult, in some cases impossible, for folks to get access to all the financial resources that they're eligible for. And so the recommendation that we're making in our written comments is if there's a way to include some requirement that utilities implementing equity programs under the holdback credit provision have some coordination with the existing programs, including primarily CARB's programs, with flexibility for utilities to determine what that coordination looks like, really just to make sure we're not reinventing the wheel, right? And this happens over and over again, and it's not out of malice, it's not out of malintent, it's just because people are busy and operating in silos. So if there's a way to add a small amendment to just require that in their reporting back to CARB, there's some documentation about how the new programs are coordinated with the existing ones, that would be, I think, a big win. We've had good conversations with staff about this, and so I think there's ways to implement it that are not burdensome to any of the parties and really allow everybody's dollars to go further. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. I want to thank Chair Nichols and the board for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Frank Harris. I represent the California Municipal Utilities Association. CMUA represents community-owned electric utilities, deliver approximately 25% of California's retail electric load. Our members support the goals of the LCFS, and we support the cost containment elements that have been proposed here. We see them as valuable elements to help assure that the LCFS continues to provide a stable mechanism to promote clean transportation in the state of California and, as has been referenced already in public comments, operates as an example for others who would want to implement a similar program elsewhere. Additionally, CMUA members have participated in the activities to develop the Clean Fuel Rewards Program, and we look forward to working with staff on 15-day changes that have been referenced here. I want to close my short comment here by thanking Vice Chair Burke for her guidance to help the utilities develop the CFR program. Some of the conversations and the meetings to develop the guidance documents, these are sort of heavy-duty, in-the-weeds, legalese conversations, trying to get investor-owned utilities and community-owned utilities to be able to work together when there are quite a bit of different local restrictions on the type of contracts they can enter into and the type of and the way that their finances can be handled. Some of these things get pretty hairy, and Vice Chair Berg got involved and helped to provide that guidance and that leadership to get everybody across the finish line. And so I want to thank you, Ms. Berg, because your work was really instrumental in that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Hi, Eileen Tutt with the California Electric Transportation Coalition here on your left. I want to say that the California Electric Transportation Coalition is a group that has long been supportive of our transition to electrification in the transportation fuels sector. Our board includes many of the utilities that are working on this program, and our membership includes many industries that are interested in supporting electrification. We have very long supported, as many of you on the board know, the low carbon fuel standard is an exceptionally well done regulation, and we also support staff's proposal today here. We have been working diligently with your staff, and I also want to commend and thank Vice Chair Berg for the tremendous amount of effort that you put alongside us in developing a clean fuel reward program that I have every belief would not be here today without you, but is also going to be a wild success. So we do look forward to working with the staff on the 15-day cleanup, really administrative modifications that are reflected in our letter. I have one question. I don't know what a low-income rural community is. There are a lot of definitions for rural communities, and there are a lot of definitions possibly for low income. I do know, personally experienced living in a rural community, I'm not sure it was considered low income or not, and I do know that rural communities are often left behind in this effort to electrify. So I just want to make sure that whatever definition we end up with for investing in these rural communities, that it is inclusive and that we don't end up excluding many rural communities that are currently being left behind, and also very, very much support the other equity provisions in this document and the staff's modifications, and want to recognize Vice Chair Berg's help there too, so, and the staff working with all the community representatives.
Thank you very much.
May I say something?
Yes. Professor Sperling.
Well, I do want to thank Eileen Tutt because, as she hinted, she was the one that really brought the electric utilities along to the LCFS from the very beginning when most of them were saying, huh, what's that? And she's spent many years doing that, and now her most recent leadership with this clean fuel rebate is extraordinary, along with our vice chair. So thanks to Eileen.
Good morning. Will Barrett with the American Lung Association. The Lung Association and our supporters and our colleagues in the public health and medical community have been longstanding supporters of the low carbon fuel standard. We see it as a critical rule to protect public health and improve public health against the risk posed by the transportation sector, so we do appreciate that, and we do support the staff's proposal today. We think it reflects the need to continue to drive the benefits of California's leading clean air programs into our most disadvantaged communities where the cleanup is most urgently needed. We think that accelerating the zero-emission technologies that we're discussing in the equity programs is critical to achieving our health, protective air quality, and climate goals and standards. And we support the direction of the holdback credit being used for these purposes for community-driven equity zero-emission vehicle projects. We appreciate the concept of drawing the value of zero-emission vehicle credits forward to put them to use now to encourage more deployment and encourage, as we move forward with the low-carbon fuel standard, to consider looking into the heavy-duty zero-emission vehicle credits as well as a future pullback opportunity. We think that the hallmark of this CARB program is really the adjustment and evaluation over time. We think that these changes today really reflect looking at the needed changes and ways that we can really maximize the benefits of the program in our most disadvantaged and highly polluted communities. So we do appreciate that attention. And finally, we are working with our colleagues in other states at the lung associations and other states to implement and pursue low-carbon fuel standard programs as a key program for reducing the harms caused by the transportation sector and really looking at ways that we can export California's leadership into cleaner technologies across and fuels across the country and internationally. So in closing, I just wanted to say thank you to Vice Chair Berg for all of your leadership on the Clean Fuels Rewards Program and to the staff for really paying a lot of good attention in these changes to maximizing the benefits in disadvantaged communities through those community-driven zero-emission vehicle projects. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, board members. Bill McGovern with Coalition for Clean Air. We strongly support the low-carbon fuel standard because it reduces emissions from transportation, which, as you know, is the greatest source of air pollution as well as climate-changing emissions in California. And it's beginning to diversify our sources of transportation fuels and to drive cleaner fuels into the market. And I think although we've already seen some success from the low-carbon fuel standard, the greatest successes are still ahead of us as the carbon intensity is required to go down in the intervening years until 2030. So we look forward to that continued success. What we're particularly excited about in today's proposal is the equity provision. For too long, because of historic injustices Our disadvantaged communities have been the last in line to get access to clean mobility. And that has meant both more pollution for those communities to suffer and also less access to necessary transportation services. What we're seeing here today is that disadvantaged communities will be in line for a large chunk of investments that can go towards electric vehicles, whether new or used, but could also go towards electric transit buses, school buses, or the benefits of, if you're in a community that has a lot of drayage trucks, the benefit of having those drayage trucks be zero emission instead of heavily polluting diesel drayage trucks. So because of the importance of providing clean mobility to our disadvantaged communities, we have been for the last 6 years among the leaders of the Charge Ahead California campaign, and we think that this proposal today is very much supportive of what we've done in the past and will add to that investment in clean mobility for the communities that have for too long been last in line for those investments. So for that, we thank you.
Thank you.
I gotta pull this down.
Good morning.
Morning, Chair Nichols, members of the board, Michael Carr with Shell. I have to say I'm pleasantly shocked that I'm speaking 12th, which is last on the list, and before lunch. I didn't expect that. I'd also say I don't have a lot to add. What I'd do is reinforce, I think, three very important pieces of testimony you heard today. First, Kathy's testimony on behalf of WISPA about the imperative to build out the concept that staff have crafted to ensure credits are available regardless of unexpected circumstances that could be facing us in the future. Strongly urge you to consider that. Chris's comments at AJW about the imperative for certainty and predictability in the program, even if the changes are small, they are important towards that aim. And John's comments at Generate Capital about the importance of price and by proxy program stability for the capital markets. I think those are all worth reinforcing. I would say with all due respect that it's easy for a party that's just a generator to say leave everything alone. As a party who both generates credits and incurs deficits, we have a broader view and can confidently assert that the CCM modifications are needed, as the majority of commenters have noted. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our list of witnesses, and so right now I'll close the record and look towards the board to see if we have any comments, or first turn to staff and see, does staff have any additional comments as a result of the testimony we heard?
We don't have any additional comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Does board have any comments? Thank you. Ms. Mitchell?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Sandy Berg. I mean, she is our star today, and thank you so much, Sandy, for all you've done. I've heard this accolades for you, not just here on the board, but from the people I've talked to that have come to me to talk about LCFS. So we're very proud of you and glad to have you on our board. Thank you for working on this. Next, yes. A couple of issues came up here. One was raised by CalETC, and that is the definition of a low-income rural community. I'm just going to ask staff to maybe address that. There may be a common definition that could be worked out. I don't know. Have you thought about that aspect?
Yes, Board Member Mitra. Well, looking at the existing definitions in other programs at ARB and across other agencies, we're trying to figure out if we can take one that is already out there and available, because that would be best in trying to cobble together a new one that may set a different precedent. But we will continue to look at the comments that CalETC provided. Our goal is to try and leverage what's out there. But if we need to make some modifications, we may propose some to an existing definition.
Great. I think it would be good to have a common definition that everyone agrees on so there's some certainty in the implementation of the projects. The other issue that came up was brought up by Zach Franklin, and that involves the need to coordinate our equity program, if we can, with other types of programs that provide resources. Because often, you know, when communities are looking at these kinds of projects, they can leverage different sources of funds and get more out of the money that's allocated. And so I think that would be, to the extent we can, and I know there are a lot of resources out there, but it might be helpful to the disadvantaged communities to know what is out there, if we can help with that effort or use some kind of consulting firm that can help with coordinating that. And I think the equity portion of this is so important because we want to spread the use of electric vehicles into all of our communities. And I think I'm just going to do a shout out for multifamily residential units charging capability. That keeps cropping up as we're looking at spreading EVs into all of our communities, because many of our disadvantaged communities are in multifamily units, and the lack of charging capability is a hurdle. I think we can overcome that, but I do want to do a shout out for working on that particular aspect. Thank you. Thank you, staff, for all your work on this.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Are there any other comments? Mr. De La Torre.
Thank you. I just want to comment, and I think it was alluded to, how much progress we've made in this space. So I also want to thank you for your hard work. But when this started, it was difficult. There was a lot of back and forth, and to be here doing yet another update, 12 people speaking, just general support for the policy that we fought so hard over several years ago is really a positive step forward, and it feels good. It feels good to not be at each other's throats. And just, you know, putting the policy forward, making adjustments, and taking things where they need to go. So I want to thank the stakeholders. I want to thank our staff. I want to thank Sandy for all of your work. And it's just amazing to me how peaceful this one was. Thank you.
It actually made us a little bit nervous. yes. Professor Sperling.
Let me just build on those comments, because not only is it more peaceful, but as a couple of people have alluded to, it's really being seen more and more as a model around the world in ways that many of us didn't anticipate. You know, one of the discussions I've been having lately is using it as for the entire aviation industry globally, the LCFS, and as well as many different governments around the country. So, you know, this is, and Europe is talking about, they started with a sort of an LCFS and trying to strengthen it. And this really is becoming a framework for how to decarbonize transportation fuels around the world. And so it's great what we're doing here. And you know, I like that we've been trying to figure out how to streamline some of these things on the one hand. And that is a challenge, because a lot of entities don't want to or don't have the resources to invest in managing complicated programs. And I do have a little concern about the cap. You know, I kind of think maybe we ought to be letting it float up a little bit more. And it's not only, and that's for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is some new innovations, investments in new innovations are starting to be inspired by the LCFS. One of them is capturing carbon from the air, which a few years ago was thought as really far-fetched. Now there's a fair amount of money going into it, and there's, we now have, through this program now, we are creating a mechanism for that, for the LCFS to provide credits to that. And that could turn out to be actually one of the biggest impacts of this program. So we just keep getting surprised along the way about how smart we are without even, without even knowing it. but we need to be cautious about how we continue moving forward. So I just want to, you know, thank the staff. And I also want to make a motion to accept the resolution.
Second.
Great. And before then, I turn it back over to our chair. I, too, want to thank staff. First of all, the overall LCFS is, as so many have said, a cornerstone and an amazing success story. And as I've had the real privilege of working with the stakeholders for the Clean Fuels Reward, I appreciate the accolades, but really it is the absolute determination of a very diverse stakeholder group that keeps coming back, and we have been together now 18 months, if you can believe that. And our next board meet, our next stakeholder meeting, which will be the 10th, we're actually going into implementation. So we have accomplished all of the structural part that we needed to do, and so hopefully our next update we will really be able to be talking about a kickoff program, which really will be incredible. Staff does an outstanding job at really balancing all of the needs. If you think about that, this is a stakeholder driven. This is 100% stakeholder driven with staff oversight to make sure that all of the needs are being met. And so we look forward, as Eileen Tutt said, bringing back to you a fully over the goalposts program. And but really want to thank staff for all the work you have done as well. And to my stakeholder group, you guys are amazing. So thank you. And we'll turn it back over.
Thank you. So I was able to listen to the testimony, but I had to take a phone call during the board discussion. So if there are additional board member comments to be made, I will call on the board members now. Yes, Ms. Tagorian.
Thank you. I'm sorry that I was slow on the button here, but I just wanted to add my congratulations to Vice Chair Berg for all of your good work and to getting us here, and echoing some of the other comments, but in particular thanking staff as well, but also pointing out one of the things about the Clean Fuels Reward program, and wondering, we talked a little bit about this on the briefing, but perhaps I can say more about this in terms of how the communities will actually be involved. And I think part of your success, Vice Chair, is because you are on the ground and understand the needs in communities. And I just want to make sure that that continues in this program, because it's a lot of money. It has a lot of impact. It's somewhat similar to the 617 programs that we have, where folks are selecting which are the impacts that they really want, the emissions that they really want to reduce, and those impacts. So just maybe you want to say some things about that, but I think that's a critical piece to make sure that all the work that you've done is implemented in the way that it's envisioned.
Well, I think it'd be really helpful to hear from staff, but the thing that impresses me is that the utilities that will be running these individual programs are meeting with their communities, and they're working a lot through the community the board organizations. And I think that is really critical. Maybe you, staff, you could make some comments as well as the types of programs you're getting inputs from the communities, and the communities have the ability to be able to customize what they need for their individual communities, if you would.
Of course. And there's actually two parts here. There's an internal coordination and external coordination component. And we heard about that through SB 350 barriers report. We are already engaging with the staff that are working on that aspect to make sure that we're leveraging everything we can to make sure that we're addressing some of those barriers. And as utilities design their own programs informed by their engagement with communities, those programs or plans to use that money have to come back to the executive officer for approval. So we also get another check to see if it will maximize and leverage what else is going on in the communities, or to make sure it doesn't come in conflict with what's going on in the communities themselves. So there's two aspects that we're working through there. What we did hear clearly in the stakeholder work group with the utilities, and then separately with the community groups that we engaged with, and then in a joint meeting that was held in Southern California, is that there is already a discussion going on between the two sides in terms of how to leverage existing programs for meeting equity needs and how to continue that work moving forward. So with the annual reporting requirements and the executive officer approval for how to invest in projects that are not listed in the regulation, we feel like there is a checkpoint and check-in to make sure that we're getting the most that we can out of this money and getting the best outcome for the communities.
And one of the other things we're doing from the stakeholder group is inviting the EJ communities into the stakeholder group. And it is another meeting, it is another commitment, but we're circling around to see how to include people so that they will have direct input within the governance and the advisory group as well.
That's great.
So I think that will be very helpful. But it occurred to me that I think it would also be helpful for Ms. Edie to be able to, maybe from a 617 perspective, to participate in a way to make sure that we're leveraging, much as Ms. Mitchell suggested. It does feel like we have a lot of resources that we're really excited about, but how are we getting this information out to the communities so that they can best leverage it for their communities?
Right, and as you all know, and obviously Veronica does as well, that we've got these committees sitting in these 617 communities meeting and addressing some of these very same issues. So that's not the whole answer at all, but it's part of the answer that they're meeting every month, and so they should certainly be made aware of this. And then it's not another meeting they're going to, it's adding to the resources that they have. So thank you for that.
That's a great suggestion. I just want to double check before we call for the vote. From Mr. Corey, your perspective, we have the flexibility to be able to continue with the stakeholders, to work with the utilities in the definitions, and to make sure that the flexibilities that are being the definitions, I'll say, the language that we're looking at, the 15-day changes, does provide the flexibility that does allow for inclusivity rather than limiting, especially the small and the medium-sized utilities. They have a smaller area, and their communities are diverse in their own way, that may or may not currently meet the definitions that we have been looking at. So you do feel that the 15-day language gives you that flexibility to continue to work with stakeholders to make sure we're as inclusive as possible?
Yes, Vice Chair Berg, we do.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple of comments, if I may. First of all, I'm going to, I think the record is officially closed, but I just need to read this language that says that if it's determined that additional modifications are appropriate that are conforming with what we've heard and directed, that the record will be reopened and a 15-day notice of public availability will be issued. If the record is reopened for a 15-day comment period, the public may submit written comments on the proposed changes, which will be considered and responded to in the final statement of reasons for the regulation. Written or oral comments that are received after this hearing date but before a 15-day notice is issued will not be accepted as part of the official record on this agenda item. The executive officer may present the regulation to the board for further consideration if warranted, and if not, the executive officer shall take final action to adopt this regulation after addressing all the appropriate conforming modifications. So I think that's clear enough that this goes to the executive officer after he's heard comment on, and considered and responded to any comments on the modifications. I would like to bring this forward to a vote, and I support it. I do want to say that there's an element of this process which is emblematic, I think, of the way this board as a regulatory agency has approached the whole program, which is with great care and caution and an effort to assure all stakeholders and everybody who's looking at it that we are thinking about and prepared to deal with any untoward consequences that may occur, even though we don't anticipate them and we don't believe that they're going to happen, that it is important to send that signal. And the fact that we have been able to enlist so many stakeholders, so many other people in this effort is really, I think, something that's extraordinary about California, that there's so much interest and willingness of people to roll up their sleeves and get involved in designing these efforts. And I'm not only speaking about the rebate, but about the cost containment provision as well. So there's a part of me that would like to say, it's a market. Just let it happen. You know, why do we have to think about every possible thing that could happen and make sure that nobody could possibly be hurt by anything that might happen? But the fact is that we've launched this program, and we are responsible for it. And so we're taking the responsibility to the next step, which I think is exactly the right thing to do. So I'm going to ask for a motion and a second. I think Ms. Berg moves. Yes?
I think we already have a
motion. We have it already. It's already on the table. Yeah. Okay. You did it. Then it's there. Yeah. So we can simply take a vote. I think we'll do it by a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And abstentions? None? Great. Thank you all. Congratulations. Good work. We have one last item on the agenda, and that is a report on the public health effects of particulate matter exposure. The CARB staff periodically provides the board with updates on the latest research in public health implications of our pollution control responsibilities. And it's been a while, actually, since we've had one of these updates, but research goes on. And we are asking our staff today to summarize the public health benefits from reductions in particulate matter exposure, as well as emerging challenges and research that's underway to address those challenges. So, Mr. Corey, would you please open up this item?
Yes, thanks, Chair. As you noted, the board has previously heard reports on the adverse respiratory and cardiovascular effects of particulate matter exposure, including increased hospitalizations, worsened asthma symptoms, and even premature death. CARB's efforts have helped bring about a substantial overdue decrease in ambient PM levels over the last several decades. However, Even as we celebrate our successes, new or previously unrecognized challenges to public health are emerging. Today, staff will provide a brief summary of these emerging issues and will discuss what CARB is doing to face these threats. I'll now ask Lori Miyasato of the Research Division to begin the staff presentation. Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Good morning, Chair Nichols and members of the board. My presentation today will provide an overview of risks to public health posed by exposure to airborne particles, as well as recent CARB work to address these issues. Health impacts associated with particles up to 2.5 micrometers in diameter, or PM2.5, are the most well understood. Staff estimate that if PM2.5 were reduced to natural background levels, we could annually prevent approximately 7,200 premature deaths, 1,900 hospitalizations, and 5,200 emergency room visits. These health effects are the ones that are quantified and used in every regulation the board hears relating to reducing ambient PM levels, including diesel PM reduction measures. However, there are additional negative effects that we are currently not able to quantify. Strong evidence points to increased asthma attacks and respiratory symptoms resulting from breathing ambient PM. Furthermore, evidence also suggests that PM exposure is linked to work loss days, for which CARB has approved research, restricted activity days, and even adverse effects on the brain, including brain inflammation that could potentially contribute to dementia. Over the past several decades, CARB has led the way in decreasing Californians' exposure to airborne particulates, thus lessening the risk of associated negative health effects. This graph illustrates the trend in decreasing PM2.5 levels in the South Coast air basin. The solid black line shows a decreasing trend in ambient PM over time. This is in contrast to the increasing trend in total number of light and heavy-duty trucks in the state, as shown by the red line. Thus, CARB, in cooperation with California's air districts, have succeeded in decreasing PM levels even as the number of trucks has increased. There are additional regulatory milestones to be met in the near future aimed at reducing ambient PM, and you will hear other regulatory proposals over the coming year to further address emissions. Staff estimates that if PM2.5 concentrations today were the same as they were 50 years ago, approximately 29,000 more people would die every year in California. However, despite our previous successes, our work is not done. The federal government is currently rolling back numerous environmental and health-based rulings. Moreover, other new challenges have arisen in the effort to protect public health from PM exposure. One increasing challenge comes from exposure to PM2.5 emitted from wildfires. Millions of the state's residents were exposed to wildfires in 2018, and this month marks the one-year anniversary of the Camp Fire, the most destructive and deadliest fire in the state's history. Tragically, many people may die annually in these fires. Many more may experience long-term effects on health as well as economic loss. As the National Climate Assessment warns us, the very nature of wildfires is changing. They will become more frequent and intense with climate change. These California maps show projected increases in the average annual area that will be burned by wildfire. And as you can see by the darker red hues on the right-hand map, burn area is forecast to increase over the next 20 to 30 years. Although we know PM2.5 from wildfires affects public health, There is limited information on wildfire-specific air pollution health impacts. Moreover, it is unclear whether particles generated from different types of fires pose different risks, such as PM emitted during a fire versus ash present after a fire, or PM coming from burning structures or vehicles, as opposed to burning vegetation. Two groups of particular concern are children and the elderly, as they are especially at risk from elevated PM2.5 exposures. CARB is funding research in order to address these uncertainties. Additionally, as you heard this morning, CARB staff provide air monitoring support to communities facing unplanned air pollutant releases, such as those associated with wildfires. This air monitoring provides valuable real-time information to affected members of the public so they can make informed decisions related to their health. In the summer of 2008, huge wildfires in Humboldt and Trinity counties left much of Northern California covered in a thick blanket of smoke. The Primate Research Center at UC Davis was no exception. Outdoor living infant rhesus monkeys, born a few months prior to the fires, were unintentionally exposed to very high PM2.5 levels at this time. Researchers followed these smoke-exposed animals as they grew up. As adolescents and young adults, they were found to have impaired immune function, changes in lung structure, and reduced lung function. Additionally, offspring of smoke-exposed females showed altered immune function. We are continuing this research to refine our understanding of how early life exposures might affect individuals as they continue to age. In addition to the health study, CARB-supported research is beginning to investigate wildfire emissions. By understanding the composition of wildfire emissions, we can better understand health impacts. Studies include the following: research by UC Berkeley to understand and mitigate wildfire risks, and in conjunction with the first study, a CARB in-house study will characterize wildfire emissions and understand air quality impacts under different burning conditions. Additionally, a UC Irvine study will utilize NASA aircraft to examine wildfire emissions and air quality downwind of these fires. The results of these studies will allow better characterization of wildfire emissions and their effects on air quality. The research also will help us better understand the trade-offs between prescribed burns and uncontrolled wildfires. In addition to supporting wildfire research, CARB is actively engaged in outreach to limit Californians' exposure to wildfire smoke. Our website, Protecting Yourself from Wildfire Smoke, center image, provides resources including an air quality guide, recommendations for using respirator masks, and video interviews with CARB experts. CARB has also advised and collaborated with other agencies in providing updated wildfire guidance for a variety of audiences, including public health officials, schools, homeowners, and employers. Many of these guidance documents discuss benefits and recommendations regarding improving air filtration in the home, as well as the proper use of N95 masks. These documents also discuss clean air shelters where residents can take refuge from high levels of air pollutants emitted by fires. With recently signed legislation, CARB will be involved in a pilot study to implement a program to create a network of clean air centers in the state intended to protect the health of the state's most vulnerable residents. Another relatively new area of research is the PM generated from brake and tire wear. CARB has had great success in reducing particle emissions from vehicle exhaust, which is a major contributor to regional ambient PM levels. However, non-tailpipe emissions may be a more important source of PM in localized areas, such as sites in close proximity to roadways. The emissions from brake and tire wear are not well understood, and their health impacts are unknown. In order to gain a better understanding of these non-tailpipe vehicle emissions, CARB has funded several studies on this topic. Two studies are underway to examine brake and tire wear emissions. Investigators from the Eastern Research Group are measuring these emissions under a variety of conditions in a controlled laboratory setting. Meanwhile, UC Riverside researchers are examining brake and tire emissions near major roadway sites to obtain data under real-world driving conditions. They are also looking at exposure to downwind areas, including disadvantaged communities. CARB also is conducting complementary in-house laboratory research projects. Additionally, UCLA investigators are trying to determine how these non-exhaust emissions affect health, including adverse birth outcomes. Together, results of these studies will help characterize tire and brake wear emissions in California, as well as providing insights into their potential adverse health impacts. These findings could be used in the future to address emissions and mitigation strategies, if applicable. Up to this point, the focus has been primarily on PM2.5, or particles up to 2.5 micrometers in diameter. Ultrafine PM, or UFPM, is a subset of PM2.5 consisting of particles up to 0.1 micrometers in diameter. For some time, scientists have suspected that UFPM may pose as great, or an even greater, risk to health than larger PM2.5 particles. The reasons for this concern are that UFPM is present in high number concentrations, and harmful chemicals can attach to their surface. Once inhaled, ultrafines can penetrate deep into the lung, and from there they can enter the bloodstream and travel to other organs in the body. However, the evidence for long-term health impacts is limited. This may be because UFPM is highly variable, monitoring data are limited, and a single monitor often represents a large area. Thus, in order to better understand potential health impacts of exposure to UFPM, CARB funded a study by UC Davis investigators who monitored, modeled, and examined the health impacts of UFPM exposure in California. The preliminary results of this study suggest that the risk of premature death increases with higher levels of exposure to ultrafines, with effects comparable to those for PM2.5. These findings suggest a need to examine UFPM exposure at finer spatial resolutions. Much of the attention to PM-related health impacts has focused on long-term, such as annual or even daily exposures. However, less is known about short-term PM effects, such as those associated with hourly exposures, on public health. An example of this would be wildfire smoke exposure, which can be at very high levels over short periods of time. As alluded to earlier, we have limited understanding of these effects of these brief but high exposures as compared to exposures spread over a longer time frame. Therefore, CARB has funded a white paper on these short-term health effects. This literature review will compile what is known on the subject, as well as gaps that need to be addressed. Meanwhile, CARB is also supporting work on the ground, including air monitoring AB617 communities, to investigate localized pollutant exposures. Together, these efforts will help determine the need to address short-term PM exposures. In conclusion, we've made significant progress at reducing ambient PM levels, but particulate exposures still pose a threat to public health. These efforts are particularly important now with current federal challenges to health protective rules. CARB has successfully contributed to lowering ambient PM levels through its past programs, but will not rest on its laurels. In the upcoming year alone, Items that are planned to come before the board include the proposed advanced clean trucks regulation, the heavy-duty vehicle inspection and maintenance program regulation, and the transition to zero-emission technologies for transport refrigeration units regulation. Thus, we will continue to reduce PM levels even as we're adapting to meet the new public health challenges ahead. That concludes my talk. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lori. We do have a couple of witnesses who've also signed up, so maybe we should hear from them as well, beginning with Will Barrett, American Lung Association, our longtime partners in these efforts. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair Nichols. Will Barrett with American Lung Association. Very much appreciate the discussion today. I'll note that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, so I think this ties well into that and all of the work that we've been doing to raise awareness of lung cancer and the connections with air pollution and other sources. I'd like to just raise a few things that we're thinking about as you're considering the firmly established body of evidence into particle pollution health harms. The awareness and the evidence continues to underscore these harms. We appreciate your commitment and investment in research into the short-term exposures, especially as well as ultrafines. I think this is really an important step forward and one that we fully support. So three points I wanted to make. First, we're working hard at the federal level to oppose the federal government's efforts to roll back and restrict scientific awareness or censor science and strip the foundational research away from our health protective policies. The proposals at the federal level to bury scientific evidence would intentionally restrict the information needed to protect public health, and we're strongly opposing those along with many health and medical partners. Second, on the issue of wildfires and the future and the present that we face with wildfires, really just want to say I appreciate Dr. Baum's comments this morning very much. We've had these conversations before, and we know that every time there's an incident, there's a lot of mixed messages coming out, and I think we all do need to work very hard to consolidate the messaging, get to the best science, get to the best potential outcomes for protecting public health in these very short-term, very extreme exposure situations. So I very much appreciate you bringing that up again, and it's something that Dr. Baum's, Mr. Carperos, very happy to work with you on that topic, especially. Certainly, we get a lot of questions at the Lung Association, very concerned parents, people looking to protect themselves and looking for the best information, and it can be confusing. And it's something that we're dedicating a lot more of our time to, is fielding those confused questions and what can I do to protect my children. So thank you very much, and I think you raised a lot of important points with that conversation this morning. I think that can also really play into, as California moves forward with the increased use of prescribed burns and the monitoring of those elements of our fire response, just how we can structure those tools to very much protect public health as we're trying to avoid more catastrophic exposures. Third, as laid out in the last slide, the board continues to really set the bar for protecting public health against particle pollution, ozone, and greenhouse gas exposure increases. And we think that the coming month, you'll see the at-birth regulation, which is just at its core a particle pollution protection program. And we strongly support that, and we'll be issuing our comments on that in the next few days, along with many in the health and medical community supporting that. You'll also consider the advanced clean truck regulation, and we think that the board can really push for a stronger rule to really maximize the use of zero-emission technologies and really make sure that the trucking sector, as it expands, is really transitioning as quickly as possible to zero-emission. So, again, the Lung Association really stands as a partner with you in protecting public health, especially in protecting the science behind the evidence of the harms of air pollution, and look forward to working with you all to make sure that as we move forward, our rules become more health-protective, the air becomes cleaner, and our disadvantaged communities are carefully protected going forward. So hopefully within that mix, there are some good talking points for Thanksgiving next week. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Mr. McGavern?
Good morning again. Bill McGavern with the Coalition for Clean Air. It seems like just about every week I see a new study showing that the effects of particulate matter on health are even worse than we have already known. Most recently, there was a study showing that an association between particles and brain cancer, which was very disturbing. So this topic is very timely, and of course, as Mr. Barrett noted, we're also facing the rollbacks from the Trump administration, which seem to actually be trying to make our air dirtier in California at the same time as they threaten transportation funding because of the air quality non-attainment. So that is difficult, I know, for all of you to manage. I do have a few recommendations to make. First of all, strongly agree with the comments of Dr. Bombs and Supervisor Joya about the need for statewide consistency in the messages of how to respond when we have these smoke incidents. We work with schools on air quality monitoring, and the single most common question we get from the school administrators is, what should they do when they've got the smoke in the air? They're clearly not getting timely and consistent messages from the agencies. And I know that a lot of my neighbors here in Sacramento were very confused a year ago when the city fire department was handing out N95 masks, which was very helpful, and then the county health officer was saying, don't use them. So, you know, what's the average resident to do about that? It's ridiculous. Secondly, the area of research, and we really respect the excellent research program that you have. Obviously, there are a number of areas where further study is needed. A couple that really jump out to me are, number one, again, what are the health effects of wildfire smoke? Clearly, we don't know enough in that area. And secondly, ultrafine particles. We need to know a lot more. And then finally, Mr. Barrett said it well, but I will just reinforce that next month you will have two opportunities to reduce PM2.5, the vessels at birth regulation, the improvements that are needed there, and also the advanced clean trucks rule, which we're very excited about, and we urge you to be as aggressive and ambitious as possible in getting those zero-emission trucks out onto the road and reducing diesel particulate matter as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know we have a couple of genuine credentialed experts on this topic on our board, as well as others of us who have learned a bit over the years. But why don't we start turning to John Bombs?
Thank you, Chair Nichols. Actually, staff encouraged me to speak from the dais, so not that I needed that. But first of all, I want to thank staff for bringing this to the board. And before I get into wildfire smoke, slide 2, which I don't have any problem with, which, you know, listed adverse health effects from particulate matter, you know, many of you may know that there is a PM National Ambient Air Quality Standard review going on currently by the US EPA. And probably some of you know that there was the usual KSAC, Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, additional panel of experts to advise KSAC and the agency. I was on that panel. We were summarily dismissed, you know, because the current administration doesn't actually want to hear from scientists. If there's no scientific evidence presented, then they don't have to do anything. I said that bluntly, but that's actually an accurate characterization of the facts. But the staff at EPA continues to do excellent work, just like our staff. And they prepared the usual independent scientific assessment. And I just wanted, for PM 2.5 and ultrafine particles, in addition to the respiratory and cardiovascular adverse effects that we've long known about and have a robust set of studies supporting, they also listed cancer, particularly lung cancer, long-term exposure to be likely causal. And I just want to highlight that's an issue still with regard to exposure. And the evidence that we have from all the world's literature on the association between PM2.5 and lung cancer, it's a linear response. It's not curvilinear. So the more exposure, the greater the risk, and it goes down to no clear threshold. So I just want to highlight that. And the adverse brain effects, which staff brought up, there's increasing evidence for that as well. And it's at both ends of the life course. Development of cognitive ability for kids, IQ, and then for old folks like me, accelerated cognitive decline. The other thing that the US EPA, the staff determined was for ultrafine particles, there's increasing evidence about the risk with regard to nervous system effects from brain inflammation. As I think staff mentioned, there are studies that show ultrafine particles in brain tissue in animals because these particles travel across the blood-brain barrier. I think that there's not very much epidemiology in terms of human studies, but there's a lot of animal toxicology, so that's something to stay tuned about. With regard to wildfire-related PM exposures, slide 6, we've known for a long time that there's robust evidence of respiratory effects, but there's increasing evidence of cardiovascular effects. So when it says particular concern for children and elderly, especially elderly with pre-existing heart and lung disease. And there was a study that came out of California for the 2015 wildfires, not the current or the last few years, that showed an association between wildfire smoke and healthcare utilization for cardiovascular outcomes as well as respiratory outcomes, and they were about at the same magnitude, those two different endpoints. Slide 7, the wildfire health impacts in the rhesus monkeys, and I always have to point this out, there's over 99% homology between rhesus monkey DNA and our DNA. So they're pretty much like us in terms of physiology and response to pollutants. But there's also human data from that 2008 episode. Colleen Reed, who was a doctoral student of mine and Mike Jarrett's at UC Berkeley, was the first author of a paper that showed that increased healthcare utilization for asthma during that same period. So there is human data that fits with the monkey data. And what we really need, I think was alluded to, in terms of wildfire PM research, is that PM as toxic as PM from other sources, for which we have a lot of toxicology. There's very limited toxicology about wildfire PM. You know, is it anywhere near as toxic as diesel exhaust particles, for example? We just don't know. And we also need tox studies for the non-combustion emission brake and tire wear PM. I think it's great that we're funding a study from Mike Jarrett at UCLA that would be an epidemiology study, I guess, but I think we need tox studies as well. And there, you know, we have good toxicology units at multiple UC campuses. And the other comment about ultrafine particles is that there's not very much epidemiology because they're not regulated. So to actually do a research study about the health effects in humans of ultrafine particles, you have to do either modeling, which is basically what UC Davis does very well, with very little monitoring data to support that modeling, or you have to spend a lot of money to do the monitoring. There's been such studies in Europe, but really not in the U.S. So, and then the last thing I would say, sorry to be so pedantic, but I'm an academic. This is my area. On the short-term exposures, this is where I think U.S. EPA staff fell down a bit in their work for the ISA. They didn't spend a lot of attention or enough attention, I don't think, to short-term exposures. You know, the PM2.5 24-hour standard is 35 micrograms per meter cubed. The independent panel that I was on, basically the people that got kicked off the KSEC PM panel, we reorganized ourselves with support from the Union of Concerned Scientists and did a proper KSEC review of PM. And while we basically supported most of the staff's work on the annual standard, we thought that the short-term standard was not really paid as much attention to. And in the risk assessment that was done recently that we reviewed, California and the Pacific Northwest were actually excluded from the risk assessment because we have bad air days due to wildfire PM, and it also excludes effects from wind-blown dust, which Dr. Sheriffs will attest occur frequently in the Central Valley. And that involves PM10, which you know, we tend to forget about, but PM10 has health effects. So I applaud the fact that staff has pointed out that we need more work with regard to short-term exposures, both for PM2.5 and PM10. So I'll give somebody else a chance to talk.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you laying that out there because this is obviously not the last time we're going to be talking about the impacts of emerging knowledge about particulates on our regulatory programs and what we should be doing about them. I think your point, which you said, but I'll say it maybe a little bit differently, is that science continues to move forward and continues to provide information, which then sits there and becomes inconvenient for people who have responsibility for doing something about it. And that is especially true when it comes to the Clean Air Act, which has built into it these mandatory reviews and mandatory action based on that information. So it's understandable, though completely deplorable, that the response of people who don't want to do anything further is to simply cut off the science, because that puts an end to their need to actually do anything about the problem. I personally am of the view that the Clean Air Act is going to have to be revisited at some point because of this built-in tension that creates an incentive to learn less and to think less about what to do about the problem. I think not because I think we should be ignoring health effects or making decisions about health effects that are based on the cost of doing something about them. That would be the opposite of the direction that I'd like to go in. But more because of conversations that I've had with you, Dr. Balmes, and others over the years about the fact that there are other alternatives than just setting a standard on a pollutant-by-pollutant basis and then devising a whole plan for how to achieve that particular pollutant. And I would love to see this board taking a leadership role in doing some of that kind of thinking. I am a member, I guess I'm a fellow of an organization that's designed to recognize and encourage senior environmental lawyers. It's called the American College of Environmental Lawyers. And one of our members, Dan Esty, has put forward a proposal for the organization to start now to kind of come up with a new model for how to, from a legal perspective, be looking at air pollution. I don't know where that's going to go or if they will be able to raise funds to do it or whatever, but it's the kind of thing that needs to be happening, because someday we will be in a political environment where it's possible to think about those things without just having to be protective of, you know, what we already have and fight to keep what we already have, which we know isn't really as good as it needs to be. So I think the research that was presented here today is all important, but I'd like to see us be doing some policy-oriented research as well. directly to be thinking about some of those issues. And I know the staff is interested in this, too. It's not exactly part of the purview of our research screening committee. Historically, we've had economists, but not other kinds of social scientists involved. But I'm hoping that as part of our dreaming and scheming about the next year or so, that that would be something that we could put on the agenda for the research program as well. There are no other actions to be taken, but we can certainly hear from other board members, absolutely.
Yeah, I just want to recognize that Dr. Bonds has done a tremendous job of snatching the mantle of good doc. Well done.
So you got to be bad now? And, Madam Chair?
Just a couple of observations. One, along the comments of our chair. Yeah, it's one reason I think those toxicology studies become so important, because there are limited resources, and it helps us target for the best health outcomes if we understand that better. And the more we understand, the more we understand there's PM 2.5 and there's PM 2.5. And now we're learning more about ultrafines. And I would like to expand on the comments about PM 10. We have made so much progress with PM 10, but the windstorms experienced in the state and in the valley gave a visual reminder that the job is never done. It became an issue in part because the wind wasn't a few hours, it was a day. And the air was terrible for days as a result, and people had to worry about what was in that mix. Mm-hmm. So yes, we once again, nope, that's not done. We need to think about supporting research in that area to help us understand that better and get a handle on it. Because, again, that's another area I would expect climate change is going to make that a more frequent problem. Mm-hmm. The other, thinking about the white paper that you talk about in slide 14, maybe there's not data out there yet, but I think we do have to worry about not just the spikes, but what's the background that the spikes are happening in, and the meaning of a spike in the Central Valley or South Coast from a health impact standpoint probably is different than other places. So that, as well as PM 2.5 being not necessarily PM 2.5, a spike is not necessarily a spike, depending what the background is. Those cumulative health impacts, in terms of disadvantaged communities, but also in terms of what the other pollutants that people are being exposed to. So it only gets more complicated. Isn't that nice?
Others, yes. Ms. Tekporian and then Supervisor Joya. Sorry, I started. Go ahead.
Sorry. I just wanted to thank the staff, and I think this is why we're here, is to protect public health. And so I appreciate that you've raised these issues and reminded us yet again of not only how complicated it is, but also how kind of straightforward it is. In a lot of ways, it's not that complicated. And I'm thinking about, I appreciate the concerns related with messaging related to wildfires, and I really feel like we have to get that cleared up. I also am concerned about the lack of any messaging at all for the daily and constant exposure that children in our communities and adults in our communities have all the time. And we've been participating as a 617 community in the monitoring and are gaining results from that. But the community of Barrio Logan has fought for 15 years to have an ordinance that would prohibit trucks from going through the community, and we have one. And it's not enforced. And so there's been renewed action as a result of a huge truck accident. And we all know the consequences of that. We're taking out electricity for 4,000 people and having a huge fireball right in front of a
family's home while the kids were sleeping in the middle of the night. So all of that is horrific and needs to be addressed. But these kids are walking to school every day with trucks going by right next to them. There's a public safety issue, but we just decided in addition to the monitoring, we would just take videotape. And nothing has been more compelling than that. So starting at 4 a.m., there's this constant flow of trucks that are going by, and then around 6, the kids start. And so they're sleeping, here's the exposure, then they're walking, here's the exposure, and then here's the principal that has to jump out in front of the truck so the kids are getting protected because they're about to cross the street and aren't making a good assessment about where the how fast the truck can stop. So I don't hear a whole lot of messaging about that. And that's something that kids in our communities are exposed to every day. So I'd like to second Chair Nichols's thought about what's a pollution prevention precautionary principle policy that we can begin to look at that is really about moving towards zero emission, because that's truly what the exposure reduction will be. And we're going to have these two opportunities with the at-birth reg and with the advanced clean transit. And I think that's really the only true way that we're going to be able to reduce exposure, especially these short-term exposures from the heavy-duty trucks that are rolling through our community. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to reflect on that, and I know we need more research, but we also know a lot. So I'm excited that we're going to have the opportunity to take action on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Dreher.
And I just wanted to briefly highlight that the Air District, Barry Air District, did hold an expert panel, and one of the experts on the panel on this whole issue recently was Dr. Bombs. So and Gina McCarthy was on that panel. So it was a very trying to raise the visibility of this issue in the Bay Area through good science. And John, thanks for contributing with so many others on that panel.
And we have one more comment from anybody down here? No? Okay, then I think we can close this item. There's no need to close the record. It's an informational item only, but it was a very worthwhile, rich informational item indeed. And we do have one public commenter who has asked to speak on a topic that is not on the agenda, so please come forward.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Board Members, Benjamin Hanlon of Latham & Watkins on behalf of MSG Forum. I appreciate that I'm the only thing standing between you and lunch, so I'll be brief. I'm here to speak about the Clippers application to OPR and ARB under AB 987. AB 987 is the Clippers' special legislation offering expedited litigation in exchange for the Clippers satisfying ARB that their new entertainment center project in Inglewood is net neutral for GHG emissions. The Clippers just provided their fourth submission, their fourth try to ARB to try to convince ARB staff that they are taking a net zero approach to GHG emissions calculations. The Clippers insist that their approach is right. It is not. The Clippers use a new methodology to claim the project is net neutral for GHG emissions. NRDC calls this approach absurd. Climate Resolve, Public Counsel, Senator Barbara Boxer, and four of the legislators who voted on AB 987 have all criticized the Clippers' approach. ARB should not endorse the Clippers' efforts to avoid what should be a very simple and straightforward calculation. ARB and agencies across the state take a consistent three-step approach to calculating a project's GHG emissions. First, project's emissions are calculated. Second, the emissions to be removed from the project site are calculated. Third, the removed emissions are subtracted from the new emissions. The difference is what are net new and what the project must offset to get to net zero. Under AB 987, the Clippers must offset 50% of their net new emissions locally in the city of Inglewood or in the surrounding communities. AB 987 provides a detailed list of what these local offsets can include. In approving 987, the legislature and governor were clear. The project had to improve local air quality. That was the reason that that GHG emissions needed to be offset locally. They were looking for the secondary benefits to air quality for this already impacted community. ARB's usual approach is the approach the Clippers should take. But the Clippers instead have offered a new methodology to claim that only about 50% of their GHG emissions need to be offset. The Clippers wish away about 200,000 metric tons of emissions. At the same time, they're wishing away all the TACs and other PM2.5s and everything else that's coming out of the tailpipe that is going to be spewed on this local community. ARB's standard approach ensures that all of the project GHG emissions are reduced and health benefits are maximized. ARB should go with what it knows. ARB should not guess at Clipper-created theories like market shift and backfill. The Clippers analysis establishes precedent that thwarts ARB's GHG reductions efforts in real estate development. The Clippers analysis thwarts ARB's efforts to improve air quality. ARB review is not about approving or endorsing the Clippers project. It's about ensuring that the local community receives the air quality protections the legislature and the governor required and the Clippers promised. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Just in terms of the process, I think the board is aware, but I want to make sure we're all clear that this is an action that is being handled by the executive officer who has the authority to deal with it without coming to the board. We did hear last month from a delegation of folks from the Inglewood area who were obviously pressing for quick action and support for their project. So it's completely appropriate for you to be here today, but I believe that the next round is going to come from the staff and when they make their determination based on what they've been given. Right. Thank you. Okay. I think that's it. That's it. We will be adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Thank you. To all.